You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to Heritage Voices, SAA 2018 edition. I'm Jessica Uquinto, and I'll be your host today. And first, before we begin, I'd like to take a moment and acknowledge the Piscataway people on whose traditional lands we are recording this episode today. So, does everyone want to take a moment to introduce themselves before we get too deep into things? I know a couple of you have been on here before.
My name's Cassie Rippey. I'm the Tribal Historic Preservation Officer for the Coquille Indian Tribe.
I'm Bryce Edwards and Deputy Tipo for Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde.
My name is Desiree Martinez, and I'm Vice President of Cogstone Resource Management and a member of the Gabrielino Tongva Nation.
Yate, my name is Wade Campbell. I'm a fourth-year archaeology PhD student at Harvard, and I'm currently taking a short break from conducting my dissertation research back home on the Navajo Nation.
Helito, I'm Dorothy Lippert. I work in the repatriation office at the National Museum of Natural History.
All right. So how's everybody's SAA 2018 going so far?
Busy.
Good to see old friends.
Yeah.
Tiring.
Too many people, not enough time.
Really busy, but I think they've been really good. There have been a lot of really exciting projects that have gone on this time with regards to repatriation.
Yeah, and you led a really great tour. I was sad I didn't get to be on your actual tour. Don't tell the person who led mine. do you want to talk a little bit about what you guys did there?
Oh, sure. So we had a tour of our collections facility at the Museum Support Center that we provided for SAA members. And it was specifically centered on repatriation. So we got to show people how our facilities work. We got to show them various aspects that are important when we do repatriation work, like our ceremonial space for tribal members to use, our records, our archives. And we got to show them ways that we work with the collections and adjust the collection space to accommodate tribal needs.
Yeah, that was one aspect that was really interesting of the tour, was you guys talking about which ways that you are able to be a little bit more flexible with tribes and which ways that's a little bit more challenging.
Yes, it's such an interesting thing that we do, where we have to adapt the museum space and the museum procedures to repatriation, because it's a new way of behaving within museum work and within archaeology. And so you think, well, the museum might be resistant to that kind of thing, but actually we've been able to be really flexible in some ways and come up with creative solutions for tribal needs.
So, Wade, I'm doing the thing. Okay. So, Wade, I know you also had a presentation while you were here. Do you want to tell us a little bit about your presentation?
Yeah, sure. My presentation was on Thursday morning, and I presented about a project that I had been invited to 2 years ago in the Deneta region of northwestern New Mexico. The paper was titled Revisiting the Rise, Governor Norfe's Habitation in New Mexico, and was basically a site report presenting some of the work that I had done with the landowner, a CRM archaeologist from the Four Corners area, and one of my classmates. The site known as the Rise had been previously examined in 03, but it turns out that the work had benefited a lot from a reanalysis. So we took a look at the ceramics, the lithic data, and resurveyed actually the entire property. And we found a lot of interesting information in terms of both the Navajo habitation of the site and some of the activities that were going on there, including, perhaps most interestingly, some cool new lithic obsidian data that suggests that they were getting at least some of their goods from like 300 miles to the south, down on the Arizona-Mexico border. These are things that haven't really been talked about in terms of Navajo archaeology, which is often focused on a few main questions relating to, say, pueblitos or ethnogenesis. And so this offers the chance to, I think, opens up new avenues for future research. And I think it'll be really interesting seeing how this plays out going forward.
Cool. And do you want to, tell us very briefly also what your dissertation is on?
Yeah, sure. I'd be happy to. My dissertation research essentially is an attempt to better understand the early history of the Navajo sheep herding tradition. It's such a key part of Navajo identity and culture today, with the rugs, the weaving. Some people have described Navajo society as being very sheep-minded, sheep-focused. But all of that has its roots in the early colonial period, with the Spanish bringing Western domesticates like sheep and goats to the Southwest, and how those animals were adopted and how Native societies negotiated the impacts of these new resources has... Well, it's one of the things I did during this SAAs was attend a number of sessions that had people that are increasingly looking at these questions throughout North America, actually. And so I see my research as part of that. But one of the big challenges has been that this type of research, talking about pastoralism, was often done using faunal remains through zoo archaeology. But the Navajo record is pretty scarce when it comes to that. And so I'm taking an approach rooted in ethnoarchaeology and landscape studies, which I think are central to really understanding the types of activities that are going on. And also, it gives me a chance to work back on the reservation with family members, with community members, and access a knowledge base that I think is really important, but often gets overlooked and has been overlooked in these discussions. So... 3 months into herding sheep. We'll be doing it for the rest of the summer. And then that data will go into making a GIS predictive model that I'll roll out next summer to try to survey 17th and 18th century Navajo sites in the Deneta area. I'm looking for pastoral infrastructure associated with these older Navajo sites to see if I can't identify pastoral components in these areas and put this into the discussion that's been ongoing for about a century. So
great.
We'll see how it goes.
Thank you. Yeah, and Desiree, you've been all over the place this SAAs.
Yes, definitely. So I wear a lot of hats. And one of my hats is being chair of the Native American Scholarships Committee. And SAA provides scholarships to Native American community members and students. We have the Arthur C. Parker, which is in honor of our first president of SAA, who actually was Seneca, so Native American. And then we have a $5,000 undergraduate award and a $10,000 graduate award. But one of the most exciting things that has happened is that 83 years later, we now have our second Native American president, Joe Watkins, who is Choctaw. And it was announced yesterday at the business meeting, and a group of us cheered him on. And so it's really exciting to see almost, you know, full circle. It took 83 years, but now we have a Native American community member who is at the head of SAA.
That's awesome. Yeah. And then you also were telling me about your panel, was it, with Larry Zimmerman?
So, yes, we actually had a session in honor of Larry Zimmerman. The session was on Friday, called From Bearded Archaeologist and Closet Chickens to Multiple Pasts in Archaeology of Yesterday. And I arranged that with Dorothy Lippert as well as Jeremy Wilson. And so Larry actually retired last year. And in conversation with a lot of indigenous archaeologists, we were inspired in some instances by the work that he had done with Native communities, as well as the writings and we were inspired by a lot of the writings that he did, particularly in making sure that Native American perspectives are included in every aspect of archaeological research. And on a personal note, he really reached out to young indigenous students and young professionals such as myself and Dorothy, and we wanted to give honor to him for being there for us and giving us advice. And, you know, he fought long and hard in SAA in order to make sure that Native community members are invited and participate in some instances to the detriment of his own personal career. And so we just felt that it was important that he knew the impact that he had on our lives and will continue to have, and that he has changed SAA for the better.
So were there any specific things that he was really great about that the rest of us should be emulating?
So one of the things that was very important in Larry's career with regards to my work is that he was involved in one of the very first repatriations that took place. It was in the, I think, 1971 or so. At the he was working with the reburial of remains from the Crow Creek massacre. And his and that work led to him being harassed and vilified, and people said, you're crazy for doing this. Why would you listen to Native Americans, and you're doing all this, and it's going to harm the cause of science? And but he did it anyway because he felt like it was the right thing to do. And he wrote about it and wrote about his struggles. And that those writings were so important because he opened the door so you could actually see how things were working. So it's not like just a paper that says, you know, here's a study about what happened at Crow Creek when these people died, and here's data and tables. He talked about the process, what happened to him personally, and the politics that had gone on behind the scenes. And then he opened up and talked about how it had impacted him personally. And it was so important to me when I was a young scholar, when I was in grad school, to read those writings and hear that somebody was going through these struggles and going through these challenges, but kept doing it because he knew it was the right thing to do. He just knew he had to do it. And so it was very inspiring. And there were so many people that spoke in the session that had some kind of story where some writing from Larry or something that Larry had done had inspired them to take similar kinds of risks. And so it was a wonderful event. We were able to present him with a blanket at the end of it. And I presented his wife, Karen, with a shawl because she was there through it all. She was with him through all of his challenges, but it was just a great thing.
Yeah, that sounds really lovely. Okay. Is it Brees?
It's Brees.
Brees. Okay. Well, I hadn't even met Brees yet, but looking through the program, your name is in like so many places. Literally everywhere.
It's only in there four times, and that's only because the intent this year was to bring more of the office here to present. So I'm there as co-author on a couple of things. So at least one of those papers was a co-author of a student of Sarah Gonzalez and a work that Ian Kretzler was doing with Eve Dwan at the Grand Ron. And they did an amazing job. They really just knocked it out there. And to the point that I'm trying to see if I can find a way for them to write that up. And we'll use it in the office. So really good work. And I just finished doing a poster, which was a little dull standing there for a while with everybody kind of glossing over, walking by, going, pretty colors, but what does it really mean? And then we, a few people actually started stopping by and we got into some good conversations. And the intent of the poster is to try and bring forward the importance of practice in understanding what this thing archaeology is. You know, my spiel was archaeology is nothing more than a shopping list right now, a bunch of nouns of, you know, people and places. Let's bring some verbs in there. Let's talk about practice and process that gives us a complete sentence. So the poster was a demonstration of that notion being applied to a particular landscape, tribal cultural landscape, and a way of understanding it
enriching that understanding and then applying tribal stories about that landscape and change on the shoreline going back 14,000 years.
So what kind of methods are you guys doing in order to do that?
A lot of computer work.
Yeah.
Starting a couple of years ago, we took ethnohistoric records that might have been written in note form, published as articles, or even on cylinders, and started going line by line, entering those into different data sets of floral, fauna, place, and then kind of a miscellaneous. And where we could, we geo-referenced each of those onto a map. As I was sharing with one person, we built in an interactive portion of the process. We could have just left it all on the computer, but we printed out a map that was 8 feet tall and ran 21 feet long, and we put Mylar over it. And so we, in dry erase, marked out all of those places that could be geo-referenced. And then we left another set of dry erase markers hanging so that people in community walking in and out of the office could add their own. And that really led to a richer understanding, and it helped with interacting and learning new places and confidence in what it is that we were doing in the office. And that then we took the Mylar, scanned it, and then geo-referenced all of those so that they would be interactive points on the GIS. But it was a way to force interaction. Yeah. It added an extra probably 2-3 months. And then from there, we worked on modeling. And the one of the things that came out of that was looking at view sheds, which was really important to the community. And we were able to say, archaeologically, you're not going to find anything in these places that are probably more significant and more important. So we can put energy to the protection and the maintenance and finding avenues to bring community back in to engage with that practice part again.
What about you, Cassie?
So I am actually not presenting this year. I took the year off, and it was amazing. I kind of half-treated it as vacation, which is a little great. I actually took the first couple of days. I came here early and did some archives research, which was fantastic. It's great to have the SAAs at a place where it gives us access to data and information that we wouldn't otherwise have easy access to. So I did that for the first couple of days before SAA, and I'm attending the meetings because this is a great opportunity for networking, and this is a great opportunity for me to treat these sessions and these panels almost as workshops and work groups for myself. So we have a lot going on as TIPOs and with the tribal offices, and so we're always looking for ways. I'm always looking for ways that I can do a better job at my job. I can be more efficient and more effective at communicating science, communicating tribal interests, in communicating what we do and why we do it. And so there's been a lot of really good conversations about how we can do better. And I've also seen a lot of ways where I'm thinking we all really need to do better and we're not doing it right now. So that's what I'm here absorbing all of that this year.
Right. So what are the ways that we can do better?
Well, I'll use one of the workshop or sessions that I think Rhys was on yesterday, or what's today, Thursday, maybe. It was a NAGPRA session the other day. So we, SAA, put this NAGPRA session in a room that had a limit of 37 people. And we at one point counted 65 people in that room. And I'm seeing this trend that the topics for certain populations, whether it's indigenous, whether it's women, whether it's some of these topics that people seem to think are not maybe mainstream, get shoved into the bottom. And then these mainstream topics have a room that can fit 100 people and have 10.
Yeah.
And so that's one of my first, hey, what's happening here? And I'm seeing a lot of panels that have really strong interests, or tribal people have really strong interests in a lot of these topics, and there's no Indigenous representation on these topics. There may not be women on these panels, and I'm finding all of these things, and I'm hearing everybody else saying these things too, and I'm going, why isn't this, why aren't we talking about this more? Why, how can we do better?
So a lot of us have seen that as well. And I actually ran into the program chair for next year, Christian Wells, and told him all of these issues in terms of scheduling and room blocks, et cetera. And so then basically I volunteered myself to be on the program committee in order to make those issues well known and making sure that the scheduling is better in terms of room size. That's going to be my thing.
So room size is one of the issues, but scheduling
exactly.
is
yeah.
the
yeah.
other.
The same topics.
All of this,
yeah.
the same topics are scheduled at the same time. And so I'm also in a session on repatriation at the National Museum of Natural History, which will be Sunday at 9:30. And there are all these other repatriation sessions going on at the same time.
Yes.
So I would like to hear what, you know, other people are doing. I would like to learn from other people's experiences, but I'm going to be sitting there in my own session with hearing my colleagues at the museum who are all, you know, great. They're going to talk about good topics, but I know what they're going to say. So, it's kind of not fair.
Yes, yes.
We can exchange notes. I'm sitting in the NAGPRA Sunday morning also. At least we'll have two.
Yeah, no, I was noticing that too, that all of the NAGPRA stuff seemed to be Thursday morning at the same time as the repatriation tour, or all at the same time on Sunday, which is ridiculous.
And then even the interest group meetings. Mm-hmm. One of the other things that I did at this meeting was to start up the repatriation interest group with Wendy Teeter, and we arranged it for people who are interested. I mean, it's an interest group interested in repatriation, and we wanted to draw from people who had tribal backgrounds, people who work for tribes, people who work for museums, people who, you know, maybe they're bioarchaeologists that are present, and people who do repatriation on a daily basis. Well, what happened was it was scheduled for Thursday at 7:00. Mm-hmm. So this was at the same time as the Native American welcome reception,
yeah.
and at the same time as the curations meeting, interest right. group meeting, and it's the same time as a new bioarchaeology interest group meeting.
Right.
So all of the
right.
groups that we might have drawn members from each had something going on at the same time. And we wound up with a good group of people who are repatriation professionals. And we had a really good discussion. And I think it's going to be a good group going forwards. But again, it was this weird thing where everything was happening at the same time.
Right, right. Well, and not to mention the interest groups. I mean, because there was also the night before there was the Native American interest group, but there was all those talks going on Thursday night. I mean, it was just, it was the women's networking reception at the same time. There was the posters after dark at the same time. I mean, Thursday night is just insane. It's really not reasonable. Anyone else have anything that they wanted to
Well, add? I wanted to talk about one of the sessions that I was involved in, which was a forum, The State of Inclusion, Diversity in Non-Academic Archaeology. Mm-hmm. And it was sponsored by the SAA Queer Archaeology Interest Group. Mm-hmm. And what it was is that we wanted to talk about there's tons of marginalized communities within archaeology, and not really focus on the academia part of it, but really focus on the CRM, professional, museum, and federal agency level. Right. And trying to, obviously, we couldn't, find a solution in 2 hours, but to discuss all the different various problems in terms of recruiting not only students and scholars and interns from underrepresented communities, but minority communities, et cetera, as well as various gender diversity issues and things like that. And it was a really interesting, we've had this conversation before. I was actually on a diversity task force a couple of years ago
right.
that SAA had put together. And we keep having these talks about how to make it possible in order, what are the hindrances,
right.
particularly in the CRM position. You have, the monetary issues, but then also, for instance, those professionals are in the Midwest. It's like, well, how can we recruit people that are not, European background? How do we recruit Native Americans or Latino communities to work in the CRM firm? And so we talked a lot about some of the ways that we've done it. And for my own company, we have interns that they actually get school credit and they come and intern with us, and then we, you know, provide professional training for them. And but it has a lot to do with what region the CRM company or the agency is in. So Los Angeles, we're greater Los Angeles area where I'm based, we have a large Latino population. So I get a lot more students and entering professionals who are from various backgrounds. So it's easier for us to kind of meet that diversity requirement. Whereas when you are in the Midwest, you know, you don't tend to draw from those. But then we also talked about cost. We really talked about costs of field schools. Mm-hmm. So myself, Dr. Wendy Teeter from UCLA, as well as Karima Kennedy Richardson, who is at the Autry, we run a project out on Catalina Island. And for the last 8 years, we had a field school that was indigenous based. And when we first started, we started through UCLA, but because of the overhead, our cost was $4,000. And that was something that I had told at the panel, is that of that $4,000 that UCLA was charging the students, we got $1,500 for our field expenses.
What?
And so in some instances, there were students that couldn't afford that. And so we said, okay, well, give us $1,500 and we'll take you.
Right.
But you just won't get class credit.
Right.
You know, we'll write letters of recommendation on your behalf saying you are a great student or whatever. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that's one way that we kind of found to have them participate, because, you know, and so we went from UCLA to Northridge to IFR and then back to Northridge. Mm-hmm. Because, but still, we were at that 3,000, 4,000, you know, range. And so, you know, that was just one of the ways, things we were talking about in terms of getting better access, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Being from myself, growing up in a you know, first generation college student, single parent family, low income, I couldn't go to field school unless I happened to have I was an upper bound student, and they paid for me to go to field school.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wouldn't have been able to have that first taste of archaeology without somebody else paying for it. So mm-hmm. trying to think about, and that's one of the reasons why we have Native American scholarship here at SAA, is to help offset that so that our, you know, Native American community members and students can get that education
mm-hmm.
And get that experience, because that is just one of the hindrances.
Right.
But so we were starting the conversation and, you know, we didn't solve anything, but mm-hmm. it is larger issues. There's tons of other topics that we talk about, other communities that we need to reach out to better, particularly in non-academic mm-hmm. settings.
Right. Do you think, okay, I guess this is a question for all of you. Do you think that people don't know how to make it better, or do you think that they're just unwilling?
I've noticed that at this conference this year, there have been a lot of public outreach and advocacy, public education talks and questions. The theme seems to be, okay, well, what can we do? How can we make it better? And then I think that we have the same problem every year. We talk about how can we make it better, and then nobody follows up and implements it once we get the conversation started.
Uh-huh.
So I don't know that it's that we don't know how. I don't know that it's that we don't want to. I think it's just that the follow-up just doesn't happen,
mm-hmm.
whether that's because we're all busy or because we don't get the funding that we need to do the implementation, or, you know, for whatever other reason. But I think that that's something that keeps happening.
Yeah. Anybody else have any thoughts on that? No. Okay. Okay.
Lots of thoughts.
We don't have time.
What I will say is that it does get something that this conference does very well in relation to that, is that it does give us an opportunity to speak to people that we wouldn't otherwise speak to,
mm-hmm.
Whether it's in the sessions or after the sessions in the evening. I always have an opportunity. I meet somebody from a different tribe every time I'm here. I meet somebody from a different university, from different CRM firms, and they always manage to give me new ideas and new things to bring back to my meetings that I can at least try to start doing that implementation back where I'm at, and hope that it just has a ripple effect.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there are a lot of people that are doing that. It just hasn't met that grander scale yet.
Right, right. So I had a thought about the whole, about, you know, things that we want to have done but aren't doing. I think it's not just that we don't really know how to do it or that we don't want to do it. Mm-hmm. It's that we're not necessarily the right people that can drive the solutions.
Right.
So we're archaeologists, and mm-hmm. we're talking about how can we increase diversity, how can we support different populations mm-hmm. to become archaeologists. And some of that certainly is within our wheelhouse. You know, we can mentor students and the like, but some of it is kind of has broader societal solutions. Mm-hmm. So
right.
support for family, support for students, support for single parent families, the first generation college students.
Mm-hmm.
You can read, there are a number of newspaper articles that talk about the struggles of first generation students, and you know, the ones that are really high flying students, really bright. If they wind up at an Ivy League college, for example, they don't have the same support that other students have. Mm-hmm. Well, how is the archaeology department, what can they do to help those students?
Mm-hmm.
The department may not have the resources to do that. That's on the university, and that's on our broader educational system. So we talk about what would we like to see happen, and we know what we'd like to see happen, but we don't necessarily have the tools to address all of the all of the aspects of the problem.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So Wade, as a student, I mean, what do you think?
As a student, you know, well, speaking as a graduate student and having over the past 10 years, you know, gone through both, you know, undergrad field school experiences and now being a teaching assistant and having that experience, a couple things come to mind. Well, one, I was lucky enough to have gone to an Ivy League school that, unlike the one that I'm currently at, did offer fieldwork funding. And, you know, it was the archaeology program was self-selecting in and of mm-hmm. itself, right? So it was already small. And I did my undergrad at Yale, and Yale happened to have one of the former professors was independently wealthy and set up a fund specifically for undergraduate students that were majors to mm-hmm. do fieldwork. And Yale made it a requirement of their program that you do fieldwork outside, and they mm-hmm. fund that. Harvard, on the other hand, doesn't have a wealthy alum of that sort who has made a similar bequest. And so the end result is that and I've had conversations with some of the undergrads who come from, you know, less privileged backgrounds. And it's been a discussion of how are you going to, I like archaeology, how am I going to do a field school?
Mm-hmm.
Because you look at things like the last time I looked at like the UCLA programs, in some ways they're almost cash cows. It's several grand to mm-hmm. fly to Peru or Turkey or wherever it is and you know, get that. And I guess the justification is that you're getting credit for it, but in some ways if it's to get the experience and to get the training, it almost seems like that's quite not quite worth it. And so what I kind of wonder is, you know, the Navajo Nation had at one point the archaeology training program and mm-hmm. that the Navajo Nation Archaeology Department, the tribal government, had funded in partnership with Northern Arizona University. Mm-hmm. Perhaps something like that would be a way that tribal members, at the very least, could access this, or to open up internships with a field component, or to work with CRM firms, as Desiree was saying, to mm-hmm. provide that experience. But I mean, I think from my view, fieldwork is an important first step to decide, you know, how you want to engage with archaeology. And my field school was in Peru, and one of the valuable lessons that a friend of mine learned was that she didn't necessarily want to do fieldwork, but she was really enjoying the analytical side and those activities. And she's still involved in archaeology, but it's not going out and being a shovel bum. It's not being a graduate student. Well, it was being a graduate student, but it was the end result wasn't trying to run projects themselves, but to actually sort of do the analysis and do the work that, you know, helps see projects to completion. Mm-hmm. And so I think having this more recent view of the way funding is structured, or seeing hints of the things that are behind the scenes, it's, I think Dorothy's right in that there needs to be other, perhaps innovative solutions, because mm-hmm. I think the field experience is key, but how do you get people in there and meet those costs?
Yeah.
So I do have something to say, apparently. And in Oregon, we've had a similar conversation about just how do we find that next generation of professional to work in the region, because there just aren't that many people. And we've thrown out the notion to the state, to the SHPO office, of a mitigation bank, literally a fund that could then be tapped for scholarships. There are a lot of hurdles just about the concept of being able to, in essence, you know, pay for damage. However, as a concept, it could be one of those sources that could actually seek to fund that next generation of professional and keep it active and aware.
Desiree?
No.
Okay. I was just going to say that my husband, he's a BLM archaeologist. He gets thrown in this podcast a lot. Sorry, Brian. but he was telling me about there's in the Permian Basin in New Mexico, I believe. Sorry if I'm wrong. That basically it's a big oil and gas area, and there's places that, you know, they've been surveyed multiple times with the oil and gas and everything, and there's really just not a lot of benefit at that point from keeping doing it over again, especially since they're highly disturbed areas. So what they've been doing instead is taking the money that they would be putting towards additional cultural resource surveys, and basically I believe that it goes that the tribes can basically decide what they want to do with that money. So I think there's been some ethnographic work, maybe some scholarships, things like that. And I love that idea.
Yeah, we actually had this conversation at the Society for California Archaeology, and a lot of us are against this idea of a mitigation bank because it's putting a price on irreplaceable cultural resources. And we're trying to get away, particularly when we're working with people who go out and loot, that there is no price. Right. And so it's almost, you know, it's really important to be part of the conversation to punish those agencies or developers that do destroy stuff. Mm-hmm. And what do we do with the money? So I understand that, but actually going forth and saying, you know, you're just going to have to pay $10,000 for destroying, you know, my ancestors' 10,000-year-old site.
Right,
you know,
right.
So that's where, for a lot of us, it sticks in our craw that you're putting a price on something when we're trying to fight against that idea.
Right.
Absolutely. And that's why my hesitancy in even suggesting it, because it does add that valuation, either directly or indirectly. And that's the big sticking point right now as we're having the conversation is we can't justify endorsing that. As a concept, it gets to an answer, but the process to get there is just too damaging.
Right, and that that is a very good point, first of all. And second of all, with that particular project in New Mexico, I think the idea was basically more that that the damage is done, which, I mean, that's a separate, already bad situation. But yeah, no, that's an excellent point. All right. So what do you see that makes you hopeful for the future of the SAA?
I've heard some really good subversive approaches for next year.
Like what?
Out of
couple of the meetings, my focus of what I've attended has been more about policy and the conversations of how to be active on the political front. And always important to be aware of that, especially in the climate that we're in today. Then out of that, you know, the question was asked, so what is SAA actually doing about, you know, a lot of this? And it came out that, you know, yes, they've got lobbyists and they've been doing a lot with that. Great. Strongly support that. But then it was, but if action actually is occurring at a grassroots level, how is that getting fed back? So, you know, the role of the Ganser group, the Government Affairs Network, resource network, and they, you know, they're talking about ways that next year maybe coming in with a panel of lightning rounds for examples of how archaeology and cultural resources can actually demonstrate in the political world how to engage the political conversation. I was in another panel where somebody pointed out, you know, this last election was won on a heritage platform and showing what an abuse and being unaware of how the use of heritage is being politicized. And I thought that was a really unique observation and something to be aware of. So, yeah.
I was pointing at his tag. So the Native American Scholarship, one of our Native American Scholarship Committee members had Bad Hombre of Science and Nasty Woman of Science because of the March on Science. And so a lot of people at SAA participated in that. And so we were passing out these ribbons for people's name tags and stuff like that. And we got so many people coming to do it. And then, of course, we asked them to make a donation on behalf of the scholarship, and a lot of people did. We made over $400 just because of the name tags.
Awesome.
But, you know, there's a lot more. And there was people who met their congressmen while they were here in order to talk about heritage as well as cultural resources issues within their own states as well as nationwide. So I know there was a lot of outreach. So I see a lot more political activism because of our current governmental situation, and we can't take it for granted anymore, right? There's a whole bunch of laws that are coming out that just are detrimental to our communities. The FCC, in terms of basically, you know, speed lighting and saying you don't need to do the outreach that you needed to do under Section 106 to have that reviewed. You know, there's just all of these things where they're trying to disregard all of these environmental laws so that they can quickly do what they need to do on behalf of, you know, basically the 1%.
Could you briefly explain the FCC thing? I know what you're talking about, but just in case anybody... I mean, basically, they just cut out consultation, if I understand correctly, right?
Yeah. Yes.
So Section 106, you know, of the National Historic Preservation Act calls for consultation and engagement with tribes as government to government.
Right.
And FCC back in...
That's the Federal Communications
Commission.
Right, okay.
Had developed an effective system for the TCNS, Telephone Communications Network System, for notifying tribes. Tribes were able to receive notice of an undertaking in their self-ascribed area of concern, mm-hmm. and provide feedback. In doing so, it was timely. It was effective. There was follow through. As part of that, tribes were allowed to recover the cost of review, not cost of consultation, but the cost of processing the material.
Right.
And those numbers varied on each tribe, as they should. As sovereign nations, they define what the cost is. We participated in that. And the under the new secretary, FCC secretary, it was perceived that that was an undue undertaking or undue cost on the business, and that it was somehow being a hindrance to the progression of the construction of cell towers. It hasn't shortened the timeline to remove tribal engagement, tribal notification. It, you know, the turnaround is 30 days. That is standard for all projects. It's not going to make it shorter, even by a day, the cost savings. What has happened is they've removed that as a mandated necessity on the part of the industry.
Right.
Does that cover it?
Yeah. Yes. Okay. Well, we're already at 50 minutes, I think it was. Yeah, over 50 minutes. But I guess there was one other thing that I was talking to somebody about today that I thought maybe was kind of an interesting point. And she was saying that there really should be, basically we always talk about bringing in more diversity and things like that, but she's saying there's not enough focus on like keeping the people that are already here. And so basically, but she was also saying, you know, like, I'm a white lady. And I also don't want to be the one being like, you look Native American. I just want to let you know you're welcome. You know what I mean? So, you know, how do you feel at this conference? Like, does it feel like a welcoming environment? Does it feel like a safe place? Is there things that...
Yeah, I remember back when I was... first started coming to the SAAs, and this would be in the 1990s. And I remember being the only Native person I knew at the meetings and walking around and feeling very conspicuous. And then it started to change in, you know, through the mid 90s. And I remember the meetings in Nashville where I met up with Phil Cash. And I met up with Leonard Forsman, who's the chair of the Suquamish tribe. And he had met up with Phil Cash. And the three of us went to dinner one night. And because Leonard said, yeah, I saw this skinny Indian guy standing around. So I invited him too. And so, you know, that was a great meeting. There were three Indians and, you know, we all, you know, met up with each other. But over the years, the numbers just kept getting, you know, bigger, you know, a little bit bigger, a little bit bigger. And finally in 2001, a bunch of us had met each other at a conference at Dartmouth, Native Americans and archaeologists. And so after that, that group kept up with each other through an email listserv, and we all began to meet at the SAAs every year. And over time, we just kept meeting new people more and more and more. And our group began doing things like getting on committees and we established the Indigenous Populations Interest Group. And it all, we kept pushing for things, and we were able to, the first time the SAAs went to Vancouver, we were able to have a Native American welcome reception, because that's what you do when you go on to tribal land in Canada, is you have to acknowledge the traditional owners of the place. And so we were able to kind of leverage that and say, well, you did it this time, so we need to do it again. And so we kept up with that practice. So now there is a Native American welcome reception every year, and it's designed to give Native people who attend the conference a place where they know they can go and they can meet other Native people. Now, having said that, it was opposite all these other things that were going
on.
So,
yes.
I was only able to go for about 5 minutes. But it, you know, there are these things in place now, and that's a big change.
Right.
You know, that's a big change since it was just me and Leonard and Phil going to dinner.
Well, you know, and what is that? 2 decades later now, it's interesting sort of benefiting from that experience and that work that was done. Because perhaps it's sort of my own personal background, but, you know, I've never felt uncomfortable here. But there is something special when you can go into, you know, take a step away from the mad conferencing, the sort of endless networking, and walk into an environment where you find yourself with people who have similar backgrounds and viewpoints, and it's these little pockets that make it quite comfortable. And, you know, the IPIG group, the Native American Welcome Reception, like, they've been instrumental in sort of, for me, really enjoying actually the SAA meeting, and then the connections that I've made have helped going forward. And so it's definitely been, I think, at least an important thing for me, for making me feel welcome. So I guess you are to thank for that in some respects. Well,
you're
so
welcome.
Yeah. No, I actually, it's interesting. So I'm glad that we've done that for you. You know, we struggled. So when are you going to repay us? Two of my colleagues, one's a Latina and one is African American. They were actually counting the number of Latinos and African Americans visible. 1-7 and the other was 11, but I think there's a larger Latino population than she actually saw. But the African American population is very, very light and has been for a long time at SAA. And Michael Blakely came in because he was in our session. And then again, my colleague, but it's more conspicuous, you know, when you're looking into the crowd and don't see a lot of African-American participants. And that was actually one of the things that we talked about in the inclusion panel. And a lot of times it's because of going through the whole degree process where their professors are white and have inherent biases regarding their intellectual potential that they continue to put these roadblocks that they wouldn't have other students need to accomplish. And so one of my colleagues is dealing that with right now, is all of a sudden all of her paperwork is being questioned, and it's at that last deadline, like, if you don't pass this deadline, we're going to kick you out. But all of the paperwork that she has provided 2 years ago, now all of a sudden there's problems with the paperwork, you know. So that's the kind of stuff, again, that's a systematic thing that is kind of out of archaeology's purview, but those are the stumbling blocks that is hindering that diversity and hindering the ability to have students there. So, you know, we have to do something regarding the pipeline, right, of getting the students through and then continuing to support them.
On that front, I think that coupled with that is the how institutions, academic institutions, handle or comprehend time investment, the personal investment for what true collaborative research is, and that it doesn't fit a normal tenure track. I don't know if that's what the system you're talking about, but it's something that I've seen and overheard in multiple conversations, actually, this year, is that people who are in an academic environment, host institution, can't get their brain around that, no, you're not going to see a publication look like a publication.
Right.
And its timeline isn't going to look like the timeline that you want for checking boxes off. So as we're seeing this tip point in this field of archaeology, this discipline, then the other side needs to re-examine how it can account for it.
Right, right.
Going forward. So I think that needs to be considered when it comes to reviewing papers, collaborative research, all of that.
Well, and, you know, the indigenous students or African-American students, a lot of times they get asked by, you know, white people like me, like, how can we make this field better? How, you know, what can we do? And it adds a lot of emotional labor that, you know, they're not getting credit for that. That doesn't look like a real thing. It doesn't look like a publication, you know, a real thing, I say, quote unquote. So we also need to be conscious, you know, those of you that are professors listening, of not asking your students from marginalized backgrounds to be educators in addition to being students.
You know, and to chime in on that, one of the other things that I recently experienced was, like, I think any good person, rejection. I had applied for a major grant and had received a notice that basically said, as part of the critique, and I think several of the points were well-founded, but the final point was that, you know, the theoretical issues, you know, are noted here, and as a matter of point, the applicant noted that could have noted that he was conducting collaborative indigenous archaeology. However, he chose to say he's from the Navajo Nation and grew up on the reservation and is doing this project, you know. And for me, it's been a point that I've been thinking of really intently for the last month and a half, because talking about the responsibilities of mentorship, I think that gets pulled into this discussion, what you were talking about, because whoever that reviewer is familiar enough with the concept of indigenous archaeology to say, you know, you should have said this as a theoretical piece. But if you truly are familiar with it, and the arguments that were made by Adelaide and folks, you know, et al. Back in the 2000s, you know, it's the goal. The goal is that we shouldn't need to say that. The goal is that Native people should be able to be involved in all parts of the process, of the research process, and then of the work that comes out of it, without needing to state that fact or hedge your bets. And so I guess if it's calls, you know, or notices to professors out there, right, it's if you take a student that is from one of these communities, you owe it to them and yourself to be familiar with some of the concerns and some of the ideas that are likely going to mesh with the work that they propose to do. So yeah, it was a very interesting experience for me, to say the least. Yeah, because like I said, everything else was felt appropriate except for that. And that seemed out of place, and that seemed sort of short-sighted. And if you are trying to hold to some sort of theoretical point just to say that you could, rather than actually trying to live that out in practice, then that is definitely a challenge that I think faces Indigenous students and other minorities.
I could go on for another hour and a half on what really is collaboration between the Indigenous community and archaeologists for a very long time. But to go back to your original point or your original question, Bryce kind of mentioned it, that there's that change of the guard that we're kind of seeing happening. And it's very clear when we go to these presentations. We had a presentation, unfortunately I missed it yesterday, but I heard all about it, where it was very clear that whether it was about the topic, whether it was about the person that was presenting, there were some interruptions and very clear what you have to say doesn't matter. But I've seen that in several presentations that I've been at where you know, a student or a younger woman will pipe up, and I see some of the older gentlemen on the panel kind of sit back and go, and they, you know, it's not outwardly said. Not outwardly said most of the time. Everybody just says, okay, let her say what she has to say. And then they move on. And, you know, I still see that, and I recognize the work that everybody has done. And you guys have done amazing work. There's still a long way to go. And I hope that we still see, advancement, and progression. throughout the SAAs. I wouldn't say that I feel uncomfortable ever. I feel very comfortable at the SAAs. Everybody is always, to me, very welcoming. But I also see where people have a view that, well, maybe you're not on the same level.
Maybe you're not scientific enough. That's what they always say. That's what they really mean.
That said, I did learn the word manterruption yesterday.
Manterruption. I love it.
It was beautiful.
Well, I heard about this on Twitter, so it must have been a thing.
I posted about it, sorry.
Oh, okay. I was about it from the person sitting next to me.
Yeah, I freely admit I wasn't at the session, but I was so enthralled by it. I said, I have to share. I'm so proud of this woman for what she's done that I have to put it out there. So.
The interruption. I love it. Well, on that note, anybody have any final thoughts? If not, we can end with manterruption because that's pretty
I think it's own mic drop.
Yeah, seriously. All right. Well, thank you all for being here. Oh, yeah, says the man.
It's so meta.
You should have interrupted me when I said thank you. Excuse me, but before you finish. Okay. All right. Well, really, thank you all for being here and sharing your thoughts.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Heritage Voices podcast. You can find show notes at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/Heritage Voices. Please subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, or the Google Music Store. Also, if you like the show, please share with your friends or write us a review. If you have any questions, comments, or show suggestions, please reach out to me at jessica@livingheritageanthropology.org, or you can find me on Facebook through Living Heritage Anthropology or on Twitter @LivingHeritageA. As always, thank you to Lyle Blanqua and Jason Nez for their collaboration on our incredible logo.
This show is produced by the Archaeology Podcast Network, Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in Reno, Nevada at the Reno Collective.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.